Good evening, Radio Free Brighton listeners. Thanks for joining me today on this 25th of June for the Human Rights Watch this week. We have a really exciting show lined up for you, actually. The first half, so the first hour, I'll be playing an interview that I conducted earlier this week with Yvonne Ridley. And so to give you a little background, YvonneRidley.org. On her website, her bio goes as follows. British-born, award-winning journalist Yvonne Ridley is well known in the Muslim world for her outspoken views and defense of Islam. She endeared herself to the Muslim community in Britain when she reverted to Islam 30 months after making international headlines when she was captured by the Taliban on an undercover assignment in Afghanistan. And she wore a burqa and crossed the border from Pakistan when she was captured. She was a senior reporter of the Sunday Express at the time, having spent nearly 10 years in Fleet Street working for several prestige titles, including the Sunday Times, The Observer, Daily Mirror, and Independent on Sunday. According to Yvonne from our interview, and she says this in the interview, she promised to read the Quran, and so she was released from captivity by the Taliban. And she didn't at the time make any promises about converting to Islam, upon reading the Quran, she was just so. And so in our interview, she talks about many things. Highlights include misconceptions of Islam and addressing issues of Islamophobia, as well as misconceptions of gender issues in the faith. And she discusses her work with Viva Palestina, as well as her recent experiences that she's had in Egypt and Benghazi. Benghazi was actually not too long ago, and I believe Egypt during or after the Arab Spring that occurred recently. She also provides a critical analysis of the Obama administration's international policies, and does a comparison between his policies and the former Bush administration. So that's quite fascinating. And we talk about a number of things. It's extremely informative, insightful interview. So I hope you enjoy that. And then the second half of the show today will be a former discussion between Mozambique, who was a former Guantanamo Bay detainee, and I believe it is his attorney, Gareth Pierce, and he's interviewing Gareth Pierce, and she's an English solicitor. She's well known for her high profile cases representing people with Irish and Muslim high-profile cases, and she has also represented Judith Ward, who is a woman who was falsely accused of several IRA-related bombings in 1974, the Guildford Four, and Mozambique. So those are some of her former clients, and they speak about a number of things, including racism, Islamophobia, apathy, and it really goes on. I think that these interviews follow really well with our past couple of shows related to Detention Without Charge and Guantanamo Bay, and I think that it's a very organic transition to a discussion on Islamophobia and the role that that plays in perpetuating these terrible atrocities. So I hope that you enjoy tonight's show. Again, it should be really informative, and I'm really excited for it, and I hope that you are as well. So I will end here now, and hope that you continue to listen to the radio after the show, and tune in next week. Next week we'll be moving on to discussing how Islamophobia perpetuates these such hatred, and how the media's role in that, but also the media's role and its ability to counter that and be a powerful force as well. So media is a very powerful tool, either for positive or negative propaganda. So have a good night, and I'll see you next week. Bye bye. So we're here with Yvonne Ridley, who is a UK journalist, and we're going to talk to her about her activism work. And we're going to ask you first, Yvonne, if you could just introduce yourself and in the work that you do.
Yes, my name is Yvonne Ridley, and I've been a journalist now for 35 years. I feel ancient when I say that, but it's been a great career. Something that I have found very, very rewarding, to such an extent that I really don't feel as though I've started real work yet. But I started off on a local weekly newspaper with a circulation of about 15,000, and it was part of the Durham Advertiser series up in the north of England. And from the age of 14, I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to be a journalist because I thought that I could bring about change, get people talking. And that all stemmed from the first piece of work of mine which was ever published. And that was a letter to my local evening newspaper, which generated quite a bit of discussion. And that was during the big strike, the much talked about winter of discontent, that I'm sure that your older listeners will remember, which happened in the early 70s. So that was that's basically who I am, what I am. I was also inspired to become a journalist from reading the work of Robert Fisk, who is still going as strong as ever. So I guess if I feel old, he must feel even more ancient, because I think Robert must be in his fifth decade now of reporting.
And can you speak to some of the ups and downs that you've experienced as in your journalism career?
Well, the one roller coaster moment, which a few people may remember, happened nearly 10 years ago now, when, after the horrific events of 9/11, I was sent to Pakistan as the chief reporter of the Sunday Express to go and cover the build-up to the war in Afghanistan. And more than 3,000 journalists were there, gathered waiting for this war. And I'm not the most patient person, and I was working for a Sunday newspaper, so we have a different agenda. And I broke ranks and sneaked across the border in the all-enveloping burqa to find out what life was like in the Taliban, to or under the Taliban, to find out how people coped under such a regime. We were led to believe by George W. Bush and Tony Blair that this was the most evil, brutal regime in the world, that they hated women, and that they were abusive and must be removed, essentially, was the message that was coming through very strongly. And during 2 days in Afghanistan, I learned a little bit about the way of life there. And then when I headed back towards the border, there was an incident, and unfortunately that triggered a series of events, and I was captured by the Taliban, held for 10 days, and then I was released after I said to them, "Let me go and I'll study the Quran and read about your religion." And against all the odds, while they held on to other Westerners, they actually released me. Mm. And when I got back to London, I fulfilled my promise and started reading about Islam and the Holy Quran, but also as a journalist covering the Middle East and Asia, I realized that Islam isn't just a religion you pick up and put down on a Friday. It's actually a way of life. It's the way you eat, the way you sleep, the way you conduct your business. It's very much part and parcel of people's lives. And so I thought, how on earth can I write or report with any authority on the Muslim world when I know nothing about this religion? And so as a journalist, I felt it was my duty, really, to read up on Islam as well. 2 years later, I ended up embracing Islam, but I already had a belief in God. I was already a practicing Christian, but I got away with that quietly because there's nothing about a Christian's clothing or behavior or style of dress that really gives any indication of the faith. So I was actually a practicing Christian for many, many years without ever having to discuss religion in the workplace. Obviously, once I embraced Islam, about a year later, I put on the hijab, and that immediately propelled me into the front lines, short sword fighting in defense of Islam. I was immediately recognized as a Muslim, and that in itself was a very interesting experience because I didn't make a great leap of faith. I was still praying to the same God. I was, changed my style of prayer, my ideology, but essentially it wasn't a great leap of faith to make. And yet, as soon as I put on a hijab, people's reaction towards me was extraordinary, bordering on downright hostility, open abuse, physical threats and aggressiveness towards me, right through to the other end of the scale where people started looking at me as I was some helpless woman who was incapable of making a decision. I was spoken down to. I was in a restaurant one day where the waiter took the order from all of my friends and then turned to me and then turned back to my friends and said, "What does she want to eat?" As though I'd suddenly lost a voice. It was really quite astonishing feeling that because as a white, blue-eyed, blonde-haired Westerner, I had never come across any sort of prejudice towards me at all. And here I was suddenly being treated as an inferior being, as a lesser being, as something to be sneered at or made fun of. It was quite a salutary experience.
And I was just wondering if you could maybe speak to those misconceptions that maybe some of our listeners, as well as I have, on the role of women or feminism within the Islamic religion. If you can speak to some.
Well, I've always been a feminist. Mm-hmm. I have been an active trade unionist. I was the equality officer in the National Union of Journalists in the Durham branch. I have always been a defender of women's rights. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that impressed me about Islam were the rights bestowed on women within the Quran. And the Quran makes it perfectly clear, crystal clear, that women are equal in spirituality, worth, and education. Now, I'm sure a few of your listeners will be saying, well, why the hell are they treated so badly then in the Muslim world? Why do we hear about forced marriages and female genital mutilation and honor killings? All I can say is, look, there is confusion between cultural behavior and between Islam. The confusion stems not only within the Muslim community, but also outside of the Muslim community. And if women were given their rights as set out in the Holy Quran, mm-hmm. There wouldn't be forced marriages, there wouldn't be honor killings, there wouldn't be female genital mutilation. That, you know, these things just would not be happening. So why are they happening? Part of it is because women need to be educated. And this is very, very important, because the first point of education in the home is the mother. So, you know, it's often said the mother is the madrasa. And if the mother is not educated, how on earth can she teach her children? So it's very important that women and girls are educated. This, again, is embraced within Islam. And I do go into communities and emphasize these points. And it is very important that people know this. But unfortunately, there are some cultures where women are not treated equally. You know, in Saudi Arabia, women are not allowed to drive. That has nothing whatsoever to do with Islam, absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. There is nothing in the Quran or supporting Islamic literature that says women must not drive. In fact, Aisha, one of the most significant wives of the Prophet Muhammad, she led a battle called the Battle of the Camel, and she rode her camel into battle and was on the battlefield. Now, how Saudi clerics can turn around and say, oh, women should not be allowed to drive, is beyond me. In fact, it may not be the clerics, it may be other elders who are advising the king. I'm not quite sure, but I know for sure that there is nothing Islamic about Saudi women not allowed to drive. I mentioned before about forced marriages. During the actual wedding service of any Muslim woman, she is asked three times, do you want to marry this person? And before she gets married, and the whole business of marriage in Islam, it's a business contract. It's not based on emotion. It's a business contract. A contract is drawn up. Mm-hmm. And in that contract are supposed to be set out the hopes, fears, and wishes of the woman. And in the event that things do go pear-shaped and it ends in divorce, there is also a financial settlement built in the contract to protect the woman, you know, because it may be that as a mother and being at home, she has no means of financial support. So all of this is laid out. And this was 1400 years ago. Today it would be called a prenuptial wedding agreement. But there it is, laid out. And I know that it's traditionally in some communities drawn up by the fathers. Well, I drew up my own wedding contract when I got married and laid out my hopes and expectations in that wedding contract. And as I say, the wedding contract, it's a business thing. It's not an emotional thing. It's business. And as far as I've been able to ascertain under Sharia law, what's mine is mine, and what's my husband's is half of mine. Now, that to me seems very fair indeed. So all this business about women's rights not being available in Islam is absolute rubbish.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that it's not uncommon for religious texts of any kind to be manipulated by both those who claim to practice it. And also, I think in the case of Islam, a lot of the media demonizing the faith and the perpetuating Islamophobia. So I was wondering if you could speak to your experiences as a journalist and how they've been in the media.
Well, the media's portrayal of Islam and Muslims is nothing short of shocking. You are 10 times more likely to find the word terrorist or terrorism in the same sentence as Islam or Muslim, as you are more than any other religion, whether it's Judaism, Hinduism, Sikhism, Christianity, whatever, you know, and that is the startling fact. The biggest purveyors of suicide bombings were actually the Tamil Tigers. And yet, you know, suicide bombing is now synonymous with Islam. Islam is portrayed as a violent religion. The reality is Muslims are not pacifists. You know, you invade their lands under international law, they have a right to defend their lands. And so, you know, they aren't pacifists, but they are peaceful people. And yet there is this constant demonization, especially every December you will get some tabloid saying, oh, Muslims want to ban Christmas. The reality is that Muslims have a huge respect for Jesus. His mother, Mary, is one of the most significant female women in Islam. And, you know, there is a great deal of crossover, and Muslims would have no more interest in having Christmas banned in Britain than, say, expatriates would call for Ramadan to be banned in Saudi, where they work. It really is an absolute nonsense. Mm-hmm. And yet these stories, which are designed to whip up Islamophobia and hatred against Islam, continue. And quite often I say to people, the acid test, if you find this offensive, or you don't find it offensive or can't understand why Muslims get upset, is remove the name Muslim and put in Jew, or remove the name Muslim and put in Christian. And suddenly, when they do that, they go, oh, yes, I can see it now. Yes, it is offensive. And what the media needs to understand is that this attack on a faith has already happened in the past. It happened in the 30s in Europe, particularly in Nazi Germany. And, the Jewish communities were attacked in a disgraceful manner. And newspapers portrayed Jewish people as untrustworthy, potentially violent, subversive individuals. They had cartoons depicting rabbis with grenades hidden in their ringlets. And this was, in the 30s. Now we're getting newspapers like Jyllands-Posten in Denmark producing cartoons portraying the Prophet Muhammad as a person carrying a bomb hidden in his turban. And, those cartoons were outrageous. Some people still say, oh, no, it was freedom of speech. Well, you know, with freedom of speech comes responsibility. I'm talking to you now and you're responding. And we both know that that this conversation isn't being censored. However, we both also don't swear and don't use abusive language because we are exercising freedom of speech with responsibility. And this is something that enemies of Islam will try and twist and say, oh yes, well, they don't like freedom of speech, they don't like freedom of expression. Well, that in itself is rubbish. You know, Muslims can have a good laugh at themselves. There was a brilliant film out last year. If you haven't seen it, please come and see it. It's so funny, and it was called Four Lions. And it was filmed largely on the Pakistani community in Britain. And so many Muslims have watched that film. And, we, you know, we've all been able to have a good laugh at ourselves while watching that. So, you know, it's not that we don't have a sense of humour, but some of these issues that are confronting the Muslim community today are really shocking. A, because they're offensive, and B, because the Jewish people have been through all of this before in the 30s. And now it's happening again, but this time it's against Muslims. God only knows which community is going to be targeted next.
And so as a journalist who is quite outspoken about these faults in the media, how have you, how have some of your experiences been, maybe both professionally and personally?
Well, whenever I speak my mind, I'm called now a radical and an extremist. And anybody who goes on to my Facebook or Twitter or pages will see that one of my favourite sayings is, if you've not been radicalised, you are simply not paying attention. And that has nothing to do with Islam. It has everything to do with government behaviour, with illegal wars like Afghanistan, Iraq, the ongoing injustices in Palestine. And basically, the radicalization of people isn't coming about through preachers of hate or mad, ranty Muslim clerics. It's happening because of disgraceful behavior by our political leaders and politicians. And, you know, who radicalized the Archbishop of Canterbury? You know, a couple of weeks ago, he had plenty to say about this government and about the illegal wars, and he was saying very much echoing the views that are prevalent in the Muslim community. So who radicalized the Archbishop of Canterbury? Who radicalized 2 million British people who took to the streets in March? In February 2003 to try and get Tony Blair to stop this war, this impending war into Iraq. The people who are the purveyors of hate, who are radicalizing people, are people in the White House, in Downing Street, in Westminster, in the powerhouses throughout Europe. That's who's, you know, radicalizing. Look at the Greek people. Who's radicalized them? I don't see Islam prevalent on the streets of Greece, and yet people are there marching and fighting and rioting. They've been radicalized by the injustice of these imperialistic laws and corporate bankers' greed, and which, you know, has hit the poor people, and the gap between poor and rich is ever widening. So, you know, all this radicalization has nothing whatsoever to do with Islam and everything to do with corrupt and bent practices by the rotten politicians that we have in power today.
Thank you for that. It's my personal belief also that social justice that isn't radical isn't really social justice at all. But I was wondering if you could speak to some of the work that you're involved in currently.
Well, I present two political shows every week, which are great fun. One is called The Agenda, and that goes out on Press TV. I also make documentaries, which is a new exciting development in my journalism. And in fact, I wish years ago I picked up a camera instead of a pen. I'm hoping to go to Sudan very shortly to interview those who were affected by the Al-Shifa factory bombing. And if I can remind your listeners, this was this happened in August 1998 when the then President Bill Clinton felt that he needed to respond to the two American embassy bombings in Africa. And in a knee-jerk reaction, he ordered the bombing of buildings in Afghanistan and the bombing of the Al-Shifa factory in Sudan. And he said that the Al-Shifa factory was owned by Osama bin Laden, was manufacturing VX nerve gas and was going to be used in the global jihad that bin Laden was holding against the West. In fact, the Al-Shifa factory in Khartoum was an aspirin and malaria tablet-making factory, and it was used by the United Nations to distribute malaria tablets as well as other medicines to the wider population in southern Sudan and the Darfur region. And the immediate impact of the bombing was to kill the night watchman and injured several others. The long-term legacy of that bombing was the death of thousands of people who didn't have the malaria tablets to protect them from the mosquitoes that were infected and carrying the malaria bug. And you know, thousands of people died as a result. So that's a documentary that I'm working on, and I hope to have it complete maybe towards the end of this year, early next year. I'm just about, well, I'm in the final edit now of another documentary in which I took the famous ex-Guantanamo detainee Moa Zambeg back to Pakistan and back to the house from where he was kidnapped, and watching how he coped with that is, you know, was quite amazing. And that documentary should be going out on Press TV very soon.
And sorry, what is that documentary called?
That documentary with Moa Zambeg is called The Return. It was a very emotional experience for him.
So you mentioned before that you wish that years ago you had picked up a camera instead of a pen. And I was wondering if you can explain why you feel that documentary filmmaking is such a powerful medium.
I mean, words are great. You know, you can pick them up and put them down and but there's something very powerful about visual work and television and film. And the reality is you can reach a wider audience much more quickly with images. Mm-hmm. And I feel that a lot of my humanitarian work would have had more of an impact if I had taken a camera with me as opposed to my note, pen and paper. Mm-hmm. I do have a camera, but despite all the huge advances with cameras today, I still think that, you know, that there are experts out there who take brilliant pictures and you know, I'm just a snapper, somebody who will take a picture and you know, the basic result is going to be there, but not the I'm not, no David Bailey, but the I just wished I'd gone into making documentaries a lot sooner. It's great fun. And you get to meet some amazing people and go to amazing places and hopefully, you know, leave an impact behind with your work.
Right. And can you speak to your work in Palestinian solidarity, particularly with Viva Palestina?
Well, one of the first documentaries that I made was when I went on the Viva Palestina convoy. And that was a very special time for me because I was outside the Israeli embassy listening to various speeches, and one of the speakers was my favorite politician, George Galloway, who stood up, and it was the bombs were dropping on Gaza. People felt incredibly frustrated. You know, what can we do apart from demonstrate? And people felt really helpless that they couldn't do anything. And George Galloway said, we will send an aid convoy to Gaza. We will send a convoy across North Africa and into Gaza, and we will show our solidarity with our brothers and sisters there. You know, whether the bombs are dropping or not, we're going. And Viva Palestina was born. And of course, we were filming George making that speech anyway because, you know, it was a good news item. But once he mentioned that, I went running over to him when he came off stage and I said, count me in. I am with this wholeheartedly all the way. And we got a convoy together, and we thought we'd get about 20 vehicles. There were about 150 in Hyde Park that set off. It was just incredible. It was an incredible response pulled together within 3 weeks. And off we went and went blundering across North Africa, through Morocco, and for the first time, Morocco and Algeria put their differences aside and opened up their borders in, you know, the first time in about 20, 30 years. Something that Condoleezza Rice had been trying to achieve a few months earlier, we achieved virtually in a matter of hours. And we thundered through Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. Tunisia was very interesting. We saw the hatred in people's eyes for the regime, mm-hmm. and we saw the brutality in the eyes of those enforcers of the regime. The police and the secret police and certainly did not like our presence in Tunisia. And it was, and the people stood there supporting us. And looking back, you could see that the sparks of resistance were, and you know, which eventually led to the revolution, were there. Mm-hmm. When we went through Tunisia, Libya was amazing. The people were fantastic. We didn't see Gaddafi, although to be fair to him or his son Saif, they doubled the size of our convoy and put their own lorries in with their charity, for which we were eternally grateful. Although I have to say, the sooner he leaves or goes or steps down in Libya, the better. So I'm just to put that right, I'm not a fan of the Gaddafis. And then we went into Egypt. And again, you just saw this overwhelming show of force from the police and the iron fist of the Mubarak regime. And we felt their violence down in Al Arish, where we were waiting to head towards the Rafah border. And we saw with our own eyes the naked brutality, wickedness, and repression of this brutal regime. And we also again saw this the sparks of defiance from ordinary people. So I guess the signs to the Arab Spring were already there. Mm-hmm. And then we got into Gaza, and the Palestinians turned out in their tens of thousands to greet us, and they were overwhelmed mainly because about 80% of the convoy members were Muslims, and they often would say, whenever aid would arrive in Gaza, where are the Muslims? Have we been abandoned? Have we been forgotten? Mm-hmm. And when they saw that a large proportion of those on the convoy were Muslims, there was very, very high emotion. We recorded this with the help of filmmaker Hassan Albana Ghani, and he produced a fantastic film which is called The Three Uncles Go to Gaza, and it was, you know, absolutely amazing.
That sounds amazing. I was just wondering, you were talking about the envoys, it kind of reminded me of Galloway recently, not too long ago. The Canadian government, I'm Canadian by the way, so the Canadian government was working extremely hard to prevent him from coming in to speak I believe it was either Toronto or Hamilton. And then I was thinking about the flotillas not too long ago that were attacked, and how the media's ability to portray Islam and the Muslim community as terrorists kind of allows these things to just happen. And I was wondering what you think can be done to counter that.
Well, you know, Canada is often portrayed as the nice guy, the soft guy, compared to the Americans. And really, every time I've been to Canada, I've felt a really that there's a schizophrenic feel about the place, mm-hmm. where you have the majority of people who are overwhelmingly supporting those who are fighting injustice, and overwhelmingly supporting those who are supporting Palestinians. And then you have this small, hardcore of Zionists, committed Zionists, mm-hmm. who are very, very nasty, very vocal, who know how to press buttons within the media, and they don't represent the majority of Canadians at all. And there's this very ugly vein that is running through the Canadian government, and it's quite shocking because it's not what people expect from Canada. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the treatment of Omar Khadr, the child of Guantanamo, was, you know, he was abandoned by the Canadian government, mm-hmm. As a 14-year-old. You know, his human rights were just carpet bombed, and the Canadian government looked the other way and allowed all these injustices to happen against this child. And, you know, he's now spent two-thirds of his life inside Guantanamo. No, you know, it's just obscene. And I was so disappointed with the Canadian reaction to that. So when George was faced with this wall of opposition, I wasn't entirely surprised, but common sense prevailed in the end. Mm-hmm. And he had a thoroughly hospitable welcome and very productive tour of Canada. I've been there many times and felt the sting of some columnists and Islamophobes, but you know, Canada's a great country, and the people need to break free from the fascists who they voted into power. We saw an example of this brutality during, I think it was last year's G20,
yes,
in Toronto, mm-hmm. and there's one of my favorite YouTube incidents, and please, for your listeners, go to Officer Bubbles, Toronto Police. And there is this Toronto policeman who threatens this young, frail activist with arrest if one of the bubbles touches his uniform. It's quite amusing, and it's gone viral. But Canada to me seems at times to be quite schizophrenic.
And some videos that aren't so humorous from the G20 also available on YouTube. And unfortunately, we recently had our federal elections, and now we have a majority conservative government. So we'll see what Stephen Harper has planned for the future of Canada. Sorry, let me just collect my thoughts here. Just thinking back on Canada is getting me a little bit upset. Yes, we are very schizophrenic in a lot of ways. But I think also trying to organize around Palestinian solidarity is very difficult in North America in general. Although Israeli Apartheid Week, which is, I think, expanded to a number of universities across the world, began at the University of Toronto. But that's just a tangent. And I was wondering if you could, you mentioned that you were in, so you're in Tunisia and you're in Libya and you're in Egypt, before the Arab Spring, obviously, when you were, sending the,
Well, I've been back to, Egypt. I was in Tahrir Square. In fact, I was deeply honored when I was invited to speak in Tahrir Square. This was just a couple of days before Mubarak finally left. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing to see this mass movement of peaceful resistance, mm-hmm. Which had spread from across Tunisia. And I've been into Libya, into Benghazi. And, of course, as an anti-war activist, I've never agreed with any of NATO's imperialistic wars. Mm-hmm. But when I got to Benghazi and Derna and spoke to the rebels, not the transitional government, I've never had time for elected politicians. But when I spoke to the rebels, and they just said to me, what else could we do? It was either go under and die, and we would have died, and we don't mind dying for our country, for freedom, but we would have been crushed and we would have won nothing. Right. Or we needed help, and the only people who came to help were NATO. Right. And I said, yes, but you know, the people who are helping you are bombing civilians in Afghanistan, they're sending drones to Pakistan. And they said, look, when you are drowning and a hand comes out to help you, you grab it. And we know that we've made this pact. We know that we're in bed with the devil, but we had no choice. And really, they didn't. We've seen the brutality of Gaddafi. He celebrated his, I think, 30 or 40 years in power a couple of years ago, and on the TV screens he had images of his enemies swinging from gallows. You know, this man knows no bounds when it comes to brutality and repression, and he would have crushed and killed the dissenters without a doubt. And unfortunately, the Arab world stood by. It would have been a fantastic opportunity, I think, for Turkey, which is a regional power broker and becoming increasingly more influential. Mm-hmm. It would have been a fantastic opportunity for Turkey to flex its muscles and come to the aid of the Libyan people. Egypt obviously has its own problems with it. It's dealing with its own Arab Spring, so maybe that, you know, you could see why they couldn't call upon the Egyptian army. But of course, the other Arab leaders, they're all in the same boat, aren't they? They're oppressive tyrants who are abusing their people. They don't want the Arab Spring. They fear the Arab Spring. And they're doing anything and everything in their power to stop the Arab Spring, which is why the Saudi regime sprinted across the causeway to prop up the brutal Bahrain regime. And, you know, these, and they're trying to make this out to be a sectarian incident, and you know, it's the Sunnis versus the Shia. Well, in fact, it's nothing of the sort. It's Bahraini people are fed up with the corrupt, despotic tyrant of a king who has oppressed ruthlessly any dissent. And we've seen it, the whole world saw it, which is why Formula One pulled back and pulled out of Bahrain. Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with Iranian interference, as they're trying to portray it. It has nothing to do with Sunni Shia, as they're trying to portray it. All these people who are rising and rebelling and dissenting, they're all Arab speakers. They all consider themselves to be Bahrainis. And so you've got this. So there was no way you were going to ever get the Saudis going to the aid of the ordinary Libyan people against Gaddafi, even though the Saudis despise Gaddafi for the way that he has disrespected and disregarded their own royal family. So. Who was going to come to the aid of the Libyans? Unfortunately, you've got desperate measures being enforced in Syria, in Bahrain, and these places, you know, need help. The people need help. Innocents are dying. And unfortunately, the West has got bogged down in Libya. And I don't know why NATO has made such hard work of Libya. There's something, if only the West had given the Libyans, the Libyan rebels, arms right at the beginning when they needed it. And I think that a lot of success would have happened now. But, you know, I'm not a military strategist. All I know is that ordinary Libyans have said to me, we would have been crushed, we would have been annihilated. And I believe them, because we have seen all the signs of Gaddafi's brutality. And I spoke to political prisoners, some who'd been locked up for nearly 20 years, because they had offended or crossed Gaddafi, and the brutality of what was going on in that regime was quite shocking.
And
of course, we're hearing tales of brutality from the rebels, mm-hmm. and this is wrong as well. And you can't just blame the fog of war and confusion, you know. Unfortunately, I think we're living in a world today where human rights have gone out of the window, where America, the moral policeman of the world, has totally lost it with the opening of Guantanamo, with abuse, with torture, and it has a trickle-down effect. And people do abuse people, and they say, don't lecture us on human rights, look what America's doing. You know, they're waterboarding, they're pulling out fingernails, they're torturing, they're abusing. George Bush said it was okay, Donald Rumsfeld said it was okay, Dick Cheney signed it off, lawyers are saying it was perfectly legal, and Obama is telling the CIA nobody's going to be prosecuted. So what message does that send to the wider world? And I really think that once the Arab Spring ends and the dust settles, then world leaders do have to come together and start redrawing the rules, because the rules of the game have changed thanks to the likes of Tony Blair and George Bush, who threw them out of the window, along with human rights, along with common decency. And we need to get back to what is, to the basics of what is right and what is wrong.
And so do you think that there's any difference with the Obama administration, particularly given that NATO is now involved in Libya? Do you have any predictions of what that might look like under that administration?
Oh, Obama is more of a warlord than George W. Bush ever was. The first thing that Obama did when he got into power was double, triple the occupation of Afghanistan. Well, that worked well, didn't it? They're now talking with the Taliban and desperate to get out, to get an exit strategy. His increase, dramatic increase in the bombing of the Pakistan tribal areas, that's radicalized an entire nation, for sure. There are more suicide bomb attacks now in Pakistan than there ever were, and hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent women and children have been killed in the tribal areas since Obama, as he's now known, stepped up the drone attacks. He is supposed to come from a legal background. Well, he's done away with judge, jury, and the trial. These targeted assassinations do with, you know, who made him judge and jury? Mm-hmm. Who makes the man who presses the trigger on the drone to send in a missile into a house? Who gives that man authority to decide, I'm going to take out a person who I think is in that house, who we think is guilty of crimes? You know, what happened with arrest, charge, trial, and verdict? What happened to that judicial process? Mm-hmm. This extrajudicial killing, it's worse under Obama than it was under Bush. He said he would close down Guantanamo. Well, hey, you know, not only is Guantanamo still there, the military tribunals are coming back. And they're saying, even though people are there who will never be charged with anything, they might have to remain there indefinitely, because there is no end to the war on terror. You know, they say things can't get worse. Well, they did in Pakistan when Zardari took over from Musharraf. They certainly have in America with Obama now at the head. The one bright spark in all of this is the other superpower that's emerging today, and that's people power. Mm-hmm. And the Arab people are showing us in the West, this is how you do it. This is how you bring about change. Don't listen to the politicians. Do it for yourself. You know, we in London can hold a march. It'll take months in the planning, and it's all over and done within a few hours, and we pat ourselves on the back and say, wasn't that fantastic? That isn't the way to bring about change at all. The way to bring about change is the way that they do it in Egypt. Walk like an Egyptian and go on and on and on for days and weeks until you bring about a change. And who knows, June the 30th, which is going to be a day of rage in Britain, that could be the start of our Arab Spring. That could be the start when British people finally get up enough steam to say enough to the bankers, enough to governments, enough to corrupt politicians, those ones that have spent the last decade fur-lining their pockets with their second homes, fiddling the books, all those politicians, you know, enough. We're going through a period of austerity. The bankers aren't suffering. Mm-hmm. I don't see the politicians suffering. The people who are suffering are frontline workers, emergency workers, civil servants, nurses, firemen, people who, you know, who are the real backbone of this country. And so let's see if June the 30th is the start of our Arab Spring, and it won't be like the miners' strike when Margaret Thatcher crushed the unions. This is payback time, and I'm quite confident that people power is going to be the new power. And once the people start to lead, the leaders will have to follow or they will become irrelevant.
Thank you so much, Yvonne. I think that is a fantastic way to end the interview. Thank you again so much.
Okay, you're welcome.